Chapter 6. Planning. Today's actions for tomorrow's output. The planning process. Most people think planning is one of the loftier responsibilities of management. We all learned somewhere that a manager plans, organizes, controls. In fact, planning is an ordinary, everyday activity. It's something all of us do all the time, with no fanfare, in both our personal and professional lives. For instance, as you're driving to work in the morning, you are likely to decide whether or not you need gasoline. You look at the gauge to see how much gas you have in the tank, you estimate how far it is you need to go, and you then make a rough guess as to how much gas you need to get to and from your office. By comparing in your mind the gas you need with the gas you have, you decide whether you should stop for gas or not. This is a simple example of planning. The dynamics of planning can best be understood by going back to our basic production principles. As we learned in Chapter 2, the key method of controlling the future output of a factory is through the use of a system of forecasting demand and building to forecast. We operated our factory to fill existing and anticipated orders. Our job was to match the factory's output at a given time with the orders for it. If the projected output did not match the projected market demand, either we made additional production starts or we reduced them to eliminate the excess. How one plans at the factory can then be summarized as follows. Step 1. Determine the market demand for product. Step 2, establish what the factory will produce if no adjustment is made. And step 3, reconcile the projected factory output with the projected market demand by adjusting the production schedule. Your general planning process should consist of analogous thinking. Step 1 is to establish projected need or demand. What will the environment demand from you, your business, or your organization? Step 2 is to establish your present status. What are you producing now? What will you be producing as your projects in the pipeline are completed? Put another way, where will your business be if you do nothing different from what you are now doing? Step 3 is to compare and reconcile steps 1 and 2. Namely, what more or less do you need to do to produce what your environment will demand? Let's consider each step in more detail. Step 1. Environmental demand. Just what is your environment? If you look at your own group within an organization as if it were a standalone company, you see that your environment is made up of other such groups that directly influence what you do. For example, if you are the manager of the company's mailroom, your environment would consist of customers who need your services, the rest of the company, vendors who are able to provide you with certain capabilities, postage meters, mail carts, and finally, your competitors. You don't, of course, have competitors internally, but you can compare your service to one like United Parcel as a way to judge performance and set standards. What should you look for when you examine your environment? You should attempt to determine your customers' expectations and their perception of your performance. You should keep abreast of technological developments like electronic mail and other alternative ways of doing your job. You should evaluate the performance of your vendors. You should also evaluate the performance of other groups in the organization to which you belong. Does some other group, like the traffic department, affect how well you can do your work? Can that group meet your needs? Once you have established what constitutes your environment, you need to examine it in two time frames, now and sometime in the future, let's say in a year. The questions then become, what do my customers want from me now? Am I satisfying them? What will they expect from me 1 year from now? You need to focus on the difference between what your environment demands from you now and what you expect it to demand from you a year from now. Such a difference analysis is crucial. Because if your current activities satisfy the current demands placed on your business, anything more and new should be undertaken to match this difference. How you react to this difference is, in fact, the key outcome of the planning process. Should you at this stage consider what practical steps you can actually take to handle matters? No, that will just confuse the issue. What would happen to a factory, for instance, if the marketing organization adjusted its demand forecast on the basis of its own assessment of the manufacturing unit's ability to deliver? If marketing knew they could sell 100 widgets per month, but thought that manufacturing could only deliver 10, and so submitted a demand forecast of 10 units, manufacturing would never tool up to satisfy the real demand. Step 2. Present status. The second step of planning is to determine your present status. You do this by listing your present capabilities and the projects you have in the works. As you account for them, be sure to use the same terms or currency in which you stated demand. For instance, if your demand is listed in terms of completed product designs, your work in process should be listed as partially completed product designs. You also need to look at timing. Namely, when will these projects come out of your pipeline? You must ask yourself, will every project now moving through be completed? Chances are, no. Some will get scrapped or aborted, and you have to factor this into your forecasted output. Statistically, in semiconductor manufacturing, only some 80% of the material started actually gets finished. Similarly, while it is impossible to be precise in every case, it is prudent to factor in some percentage of loss for managerial projects as well. Step 3. What to do to close the gap? The final step of planning consists of undertaking new tasks or modifying old ones to close the gap between your environmental demand and what your present activities will yield. The first question is, what do you need to do to close the gap? The second is, what can you do to close the gap? Consider each question separately, and then decide what you actually will do, evaluating what effect your actions will have on narrowing the gap and when. The set of actions you decide upon is your strategy. Much confusion exists between what is strategy and what is tactics. Although the distinction is rarely of practical significance, here's one that might be useful. As you formulate in words what you plan to do, the most abstract and general summary of those actions meaningful to you is your strategy. What you'll do to implement the strategy is your tactics. Frequently, a strategy at one managerial level is the tactical concern of the next higher level. Let's return to our mailroom. Assume that the manager of corporate communications has decided to install electronic mail service between all manufacturing plants. This is his strategy, a plan of action to improve communications capability between plants. The mailroom manager then has to do certain things to provide service when electronic mail equipment is put in place. For instance, his strategy may be to install printers in the mailroom and set up a service to deliver printed copies throughout the building. The mailroom manager's strategy is the communications manager's tactics. Some examples. As he defined his present environment and status, Bruce, an Intel marketing manager, found that he had only 3 people in his department who could possibly handle a huge inventory of projects. As he looked at his desired future status, he concluded that every single one of the projects had to be completed. Not finishing everything would result in significant extra cost and far more effort later. Bruce was faced with a genuine dilemma, especially since the budget kept him from hiring more people. He realized that the best he could do was to narrow the gap a bit, getting the projects and his group's capacity to complete them to converge. A complete match was impossible. Bruce decided to move as many non-critical tasks as possible to other groups in the company, groups less qualified for them than his own, but also less busy. He also made arrangements with his manager to bring a summer student on board to help with some easily definable tasks, and then set himself up to monitor the performance of his group tightly. He also proceeded to look at other avenues that could help him in the longer term, such as splitting the job of completing some of the work with other similar marketing groups in the company, and eliminating any duplication of effort between them. Finally, Bruce initiated a request to increase the size of his organization. His plan, and the obvious reality that full convergence between his tasks and his capabilities was not possible even after going the extra mile, would lay the basis for his request. Let's illustrate with another example. Our middle manager, Cindy, the manufacturing process engineer whom we've met before, is responsible for maintaining and improving the process by which complex microchips are produced in a plant. She defines her environment as a collection of objects and influences. The objects are new processes and manufacturing tools that have not yet been tested in production. The influences are the people who can affect her work directly or indirectly. Development engineers, for example, would like her to require less experimentation and documentation before she chooses to implement new processes they have developed. Meanwhile, production engineers would like her to provide more experimentation and documentation on these same new processes. And finally, there are the product engineers eager to get chips out the door who need her help to do that, along with other members of the production team who put pressure on her to ensure that the new processes are manufacturable and the new manufacturing tools work as soon as they are put to use. Cindy herself works like a consultant, advising each group influencing her about whether something can go into production. The chief coordinator for the set of events required to put a product, a process, or a tool on stream. Her customer is the production area itself, and her vendors are the engineering groups from production, development, and product engineering. Analyzing her present status, Cindy found that the data and experimentation she needed from the development group always came in incomplete. Looking into matters further, she found that providing complete data and adhering to schedules were not really high on the development engineer's set of priorities. Determining where she needed to go, it was clear to Cindy that she must have all future new processes and production machinery tested, debugged, demonstrated, and most important, accompanied by the necessary data for them to be accepted and used by the production engineers, who had become more demanding because of past problems. Cindy then defined her strategy, her plan of action, to get there. She specified exactly what steps had to be completed before any new process was to be implemented or tool deployed. Then she used time offsets, remember the breakfast factory, to determine when each step needed to be done in order for her entire plan to be completed on time. Next, she got the manager of the development engineers to agree to her detailed schedule. She negotiated with him what she had to do and what they had to do, and by what date, in order to meet what became the mutually agreed upon goals. Finally, to ensure that she stayed on track, she decided to monitor all of her vendors on a weekly basis. She would also publish their performance against the schedule to motivate them to meet key dates, an indicator, and to tell her about potential problems, a window in the black box. The output of the planning process. The key to both Bruce's and Cindy's efforts is that their planning produced tasks that had to be performed now in order to affect future events. I have seen far too many people who, upon recognizing today's gap, try very hard to determine what decision has to be made to close it. But today's gap represents a failure of planning sometime in the past. By analogy, forcing ourselves to concentrate on the decisions needed to fix today's problem is like scurrying after our car has already run out of gas. Clearly, we should have filled up earlier. To avoid such a fate, remember that as you plan, you must answer the question, what do I have to do today to solve, or better avoid, tomorrow's problem? Thus, the true output of the planning process is the set of tasks it causes to be implemented. The output of Intel's annual plan, for instance, is the actions taken and changes prompted as a result of the thinking process that took place throughout the organization. I, for one, hardly ever look at the bound volume finally called the annual plan. In other words, the output of the planning process is the decisions made and the actions taken as a result of the process. How far ahead should the planners look? At Intel, we put ourselves through an annual strategic long-range planning effort in which we examine our future 5 years off. But what is really being influenced here? It is the next year, and only the next year. We will have another chance to replan the second of the 5 years in the next year's long-range planning meeting, when that year will become the first year of the five. So keep in mind that you implement only that portion of a plan that lies within the time window between now and the next time you go through the exercise. Everything else you can look at again. We should also be careful not to plan too frequently, allowing ourselves time to judge the impact of the decisions we made and to determine whether our decisions were on the right track or not. In other words, we need the feedback that will be indispensable to our planning the next time around. Who should be involved in the planning process? The operating management of the organization. Why? Because the idea that planners can be people apart from those implementing the plan simply does not work. Planning cannot be made a separate career, but is instead a key managerial activity, one with enormous leverage through its impact on the future performance of an organization. But this leverage can only be realized through a marriage, and a good collaborative one at that, between planning and implementation. Finally, remember that by saying yes to projects, a course of action, or whatever, you are implicitly saying no to something else. Each time you make a commitment, you forfeit your chance to commit to something else. This, of course, is an inevitable, inescapable consequence of allocating any finite resource. People who plan have to have the guts, honesty, and discipline to drop projects as well as to initiate them, to shake their heads no as well as to smile yes. Management by objectives, the planning process applied to daily work. The system of management by objectives assumes that because our concerns here are short range, we should know quite well what our environment demands from us. Thus, management by objectives, MBO, concentrates on steps 2 and 3 of the planning process and tries very hard to make them specific. The idea behind MBO is extremely simple. If you don't know where you're going, you will not get there. Or as an old Indian saying puts it, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. A successful MBO system needs only to answer 2 questions. 1. Where do I want to go? The answer provides the objective. 2. How will I pace myself to see if I am getting there? The answer gives us milestones, or key results. To illustrate an objective and a key result, consider the following. I want to go to the airport to catch a plane in an hour. That is my objective. I know that I must drive through towns A, B, and C on my way there. My key results become reaching A, B, and C in 10, 20, and 30 minutes respectively. If I have been driving for 20 minutes and haven't yet made town A, I know I'm lost. Unless I get off the highway and ask someone for directions, I probably won't make my flight. Upon what time period should an MBO system focus? MBO is largely designed to provide feedback relevant to the specific task at hand. It should tell us how we are doing, so we can make adjustments in whatever we are doing if need be, such as getting off the highway and asking for directions. For the feedback to be effective, it must be received very soon after the activity it is measuring occurs. Accordingly, an MBO system should set objectives for a relatively short period. For example, if we plan on a yearly basis, the corresponding MBO system's time frame should be at least as often as quarterly, or perhaps even monthly. The one thing an MBO system should provide, par excellence, is focus. This can only happen if we keep the number of objectives small. In practice, this is rare, and here, as elsewhere, we fall victim to our inability to say no, in this case, to too many objectives. We must realize, and act on the realization, that if we try to focus on everything, we focus on nothing. A few extremely well-chosen objectives impart a clear message about what we say yes to and what we say no to, which is what we must have if an MBO system is to work. Two case histories. To familiarize ourselves with the MBO system, let's look at a case history, Columbus' discovery of the New World. Though how I tell the story takes considerable liberties with the grammar school version of the event. Thanks to its annual planning process of 1491, the government of Spain concluded that it could not continue a war everybody felt was utterly necessary unless money became available to buy weapons and ammunition. Since pushing the Moors out of Spain was the supreme goal of Queen Isabella's government, the Queen needed the funds to do it. Isabella decided she would get money by dramatically improving Spain's foreign trade balance. She then talked to her subordinate, Christopher Columbus, and told him about her objective. Columbus agreed to think about various ways to do what she wanted, and after a time, went back to her with several suggestions, which included finding pirate-free passage to England, and perhaps finding a new route to the Orient. Isabella and Columbus discussed the entire matter freely, eventually reaching a clear decision that he would look for a new route to the east. Once the decision was made, Columbus began to think of all the things that he would need to do to accomplish his intent. In MBO terms, the Queen defined her own objective, increase Spain's wealth. Columbus and the Queen then agreed upon his objective, find a new route to the Orient. Columbus then went on to formulate the key results by which he would pace himself, which included obtaining several ships, training crews, conducting a shakedown cruise, setting sail, and so forth, with each possessing a specific deadline. The relationship between Isabella's and Columbus' objectives is clear. The Queen wanted to increase her nation's wealth, while Columbus wanted to find a safe trade route to the Orient. And we see a nesting hierarchy of objectives. If the subordinates' objectives are met, the supervisors will be as well. Now, the key results can come in like clockwork, but the objectives can still be missed. For Columbus, the key results were relatively easy to achieve. But he most certainly did not find a new trade route to China, and therefore failed to meet his objective. Did Columbus perform well even though he failed by strict MBO terms? He did discover the New World, and that was a source of incalculable wealth for Spain. So it is entirely possible for a subordinate to perform well and be rated well even though he missed his specified objective. The MBO system is meant to pace a person, to put a stopwatch in his own hand so he can gauge his own performance. It is not a legal document upon which to base a performance review, but should be just one input used to determine how well an individual is doing. If the supervisor mechanically relies on the MBO system to evaluate his subordinate's performance, or if the subordinate uses it rigidly and forgoes taking advantage of an emerging opportunity because it was not a specified objective or key result, then both are behaving in a petty and unprofessional fashion. Let's illustrate the workings of the MBO system using the decision about Intel's plant expansion in the Philippines. The Far East construction manager had an objective that read, "Obtain decision on Philippine plant expansion." The key results supporting the objective were: 1. Do a study of land availability near the present plant and at other acceptable locations by June. 2. Do financial analyses showing the trade-offs between land costs and construction costs, as well as the operating costs associated with the two locations. 3. Present the results to the plant location steering group and obtain a decision from them. 4. Have Grove ratify the decision by October. Each key result was accomplished and the objective was met. Note that the objective is relatively short range, and the key results are so specific that a person knows without question whether he has completed them and done it on time or not. Accordingly, to be useful, a key result must contain very specific wording and dates, so that when deadline time arrives, there is no room for ambiguity. As you might have guessed, the Far East construction manager's supervisor had an objective that read, "Ensure that all plant expansion projects stay on schedule." To support this objective, he in turn had a key result, much like his subordinate's objective, that said, "Obtain Philippine plant expansion decision by October." You can now see, I hope, the parallels between how Isabella's government and Intel work. A manager's objectives are supported by an appropriate set of key results. His objectives, in turn, are tied to his supervisor's objectives, so that if the manager meets his objectives, his supervisor will meet his. But the MBO system cannot be run mechanically by a computer. The system requires judgment and common sense to set the hierarchy of objectives and the key results that support them. Both judgment and common sense are also required when using MBO to guide you in your work from one day to the next.